something inside that we need so much. The sight of a touch or the scent of a sound or the strength of an oak roots deep in the ground. The wonder of flowers to be covered and then to burst up through tarmac to the sun again. Or to fly to the sun without burning a wing. To lie in a meadow and hear the grass sing. To have all these things in our memories hoard and to use them.
Take a ride? To talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It certainly is. Good morning, everybody. You're in the right place for a ride, all right. Coming up in a moment, Robert Zimmern. He's an award-winning space historian, writing articles and books on issues of science, history, technology, and culture. He also writes a weekly column on the aerospace industry called Space Watch for United Press International. That's prestigious. His most recent book, Leaving Earth, Space Stations, Rival Superpowers, and the Quest for Interplanetary Travel, was awarded the Eugene M. Emmy Award by the American Astronautical Society for the best popular space history in 2003. In 2000, he was co-winner of the David N. Schramm Award, given by the High Energy Astrophysics Division of the American Astronomical Society for Science Journalism. In a moment, Robert Zimmerman. Well, all right. Here is a space historian, Robert Zimmerman. Welcome to the program.
Art, I'm very glad to be back. Every time, it's been a pleasure.
Well, it's good to have you. As a space historian, Robert, how are we doing? When you look at the history of the world's venture into space, I'm talking about the really big picture here.
Yeah.
How are we doing?
You know, I think we're about to finally, without equivocation, in fact, without anything able to stop it, we're about to start the real grand adventure of settling and colonizing the solar system. All the pieces are in place. The gears are beginning to build up. The momentum is beginning to build real strong, not just in the United States, but, of course, the world. I mean, big picture, China is now the third country to put humans in space. Come this fall, September or so, they're going to do a second man mission, they say.
Right.
And I have no reason not to believe them. Two-man mission for at least 5 days. And the truth, right now, they have the best manned space capsule of any nation, because we don't have anything, and the Russians is not as good as theirs. Russia, just last week, said they're going to try to do a flyby of Mars by 2014. And based on what I wrote about in Leaving Earth, they have all the pieces in place. They understand how to do it much better than
why we do a flyby of Mars? I mean, it's going to take a long time and a lot of resources to get to Mars. Arguably, in a flyby, they're not going to gather any more information, certainly, than our photographic robots and or our little creepy crawlies have gathered by flying by Mars. So,
well, you see, you have to distinguish between two forms of knowledge. The robots and a landing. If your goal is just scientific knowledge, then you're right, they won't be gaining much knowledge. But if your goal is the engineering knowledge necessary to learn how to settle the solar system, travel to other planets, then the flyby is priceless, because it teaches you how to live in space long enough to get from one point to another, not just how to live there, but how to build a vessel that can keep you
alive. Do you think that the Russians and previously the Soviets had learned so much about how to keep people in orbit, in weightlessness for extended periods of time, that they're ready to get away with it?
Well, they're not quite ready, and they admit it, but they are far closer than anybody else. I mean, they've done the research to do long-term missions. They have four people who've spent more than a year in space already, and they have the medical data to see what the consequences are.
Right.
And on top of that...
But there are consequences, by the way,
right? Oh, there are definitely consequences. I mean, I talk about that at great length. You've got the bone density issue. You lose about 0.5% of bone density per month. But the Russians are very convinced that with certain medicine and exercise, they can keep that loss of bone density in the weight-bearing bones to that rate, if not less. And they have missions to prove it.
Or come up with artificial gravity.
Yeah, but they're not going to go for that initially. Hmm. When they built Mir, Mir was basically an interplanetary spaceship that could get you to on a flyby to Mars. It was built with that in mind. And the only thing it lacked was the engines and the AV and the navigational, the engines mostly, to get it on a flyby mission.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they were planning to build what they called Mir 2, and they wanted originally, the Soviet Union planned to launch it in the early 90s. They ran out of money. The Soviet Union fell apart. But Mir 2 is in orbit right now because they got the United States to pay them for most of their half of the International Space Station.
Yeah, they're good at that.
And the actual hull of Mir 2 is what they use for the habitation module, Zvezda, that's in orbit right now. And their half of the International Space Station is going to be Mir 2. And the original plans with Mir 2, and they haven't changed from those plans, was to upgrade Mir to a level where you could add the engines and use it as an interplanetary spaceship. That was their plan. And they have said they're going to complete their half of the International Space Station by 2010. And they're making it self-contained, their half. They could detach it from our half, and it would still function. So 2014, for them to do a flyby, it's possible. It might not happen, but it is definitely a possibility. And in that grand picture, the larger picture of the grand adventure, that's exciting. Plus, you have Japan is reassessing its space program because it wants to compete with China. You have the Indian. India is aggressively, in the last year, decided it wants to have its own very successful space program, and they have a good space program right now,
you know,
but they're upgrading it.
The only thing that seems to get us to do things in space is competitiveness. That got us to the moon. We were competitive then, and now maybe there's a little more competition building, as you just articulated, and maybe that'll get someone somewhere. Otherwise, we don't seem to go, unless it's like we're going to beat the other guy.
It's the only way it works. Cooperation doesn't do anything. It slows things down, and things become bloated and not very effective, as is in the International Space Station.
Hmm.
And you actually end up building up friction between people and hostilities and resentments because people are trying to work together, and neither is getting anything accomplished. But competition, peaceful competition, such as capitalism, really gets the engines fired. And you could see that with the XPRIZE last year. And
oh, that was cool.
Oh, it was so cool. And it was exactly the right thing. And it's being followed up now with Bigelow's America's Prize, which is going to demand a orbital mission by the end of this decade.
Do you know what else Bigelow's doing, by the way?
You mean his space habitat?
Yes, well, Bigelow Aerospace.
I mean, he's got lots of stuff. He doesn't want to be the man to put people in orbit. I mean, to launch them into orbit. He's looking for someone else to do that. But he absolutely wants to have hotels in space.
Oh, yes. Yes,
indeed. He's going to do it. He's going to do it. I mean, I've talked to his company and the people that work for him. They've got the habitat, the modules actually built. They've got a prototype. They've got a small-scale model ready to launch almost. All they need is a cheap launch facility.
I know they've come a very long way, more than the American people know. I'm friends with Robert, and so I know quite a bit about it.
Oh, well, you know, you actually might have more information than me. I do know this, that they're serious, and they're not alone in this. You know, I've seen and looked into Elon Musk's Falcon rocket. This is the guy who did PayPal and sold it to eBay for $1 billion+, and he's now going into the rocket industry. And in the next year or so, he wants to capture the rocket industry back from the Russians.
And then there's Gene Myers, Space Island Group.
Yes.
You know about them? There's,
yes.
So there are a number of...
It's, private end. I hadn't, you know, I was giving you the other nations, the international political end. European Space Agency wants to do it, but I hadn't even gotten, you know, we segued into the private end, which is actually much more exciting. And then you got NASA and George Bush's proposal to, you know, return to the moon. What Bush has done, and we talked about this last year, he has put focus into NASA that has not existed for 30 years. And it's a really, in that sense, it's a really good thing.
Well, I was fortunate to have lived during the years when we had the promise that we were going to go to the moon.
Yes, me too.
And it brought America together in a way that I haven't seen America together since. Perhaps in the days immediately following 9/11, in a way we were together, and now look at us. But really, we need that large national goal. We need something bigger than ourselves to pursue. And you're very optimistic as a historian. For me, I look at it and I think, gee, we did that, and then we sort of stopped.
Now, if you're talking about the actual program that Kennedy did, and the how it makes you, from experience, it would make you skeptical of whether Bush's proposal can accomplish anything long term. I respect that skepticism. In fact, I've written on my UPI column extensively about how there are doubts about whether NASA can pull this off. However, I do repeat, his proposal is unusual in that, unlike Kennedy's or any other president's, it is the first thoughtful, long-term, open-ended proposal that is carefully worked out, that is incremental in growth, that doesn't have any particular one stunt achievement that then ends things. It's open-ended. As Bush said, this is not a goal but a journey. And that's the right idea. So from that respect, it's a good thing. And I'm being, you know, I sound like I'm a NASA lovey here, and people who read my stuff, I have a lot of problems with NASA, and I have a great deal of doubts of whether NASA can pull this off. I think it's very likely the private American industry, come 2010, will be in a position to kind of like wave goodbye to NASA as they head off to the moon. I hope that's the case. But I once again, this is just that longer vision in your first question, Art. If you look at all these factors, I wrote a column in which I compared the George Bush Sr. in 1989 made an almost identical proposal to his son. And his proposal hit the ground like a lead balloon. In fact, it just vanished in less than a month from any discussion, never even got anywhere.
Why do you think that occurred?
The political atmosphere at the time was just not into it. And first of all, you had a Democratic Congress, which is the Democrats generally oppose this kind of spending, and that's their political position. Today, you have a very different atmosphere, and it's not just that there's a Republican Congress. I think it's the nation itself, even among scientists. Scientists have, since the 70s, opposed, generally, manned space exploration. They think it robs their unmanned research stuff.
That's right.
Yeah, that's changing. I've talked to a lot of astronomers and a lot of scientists, and there's still that knee-jerk opposition.
Well,
but
give
instead,
me.
I get a lot of guys and gals who say to me, "Well, you know, we're curious. Maybe this is not a bad thing."
Give me your best argument for why we need men in space at all. I mean, there are many who are arguing, as you just pointed out, we don't need men in space. The machines can do it faster, cheaper, more efficiently.
They cannot.
Give me
your best
argument.
Well, I can give you 100 arguments. The first of all, they don't do it more cheaply. They're efficient and good scouts. But the bottom line is, why should they have all the fun?
The machines?
Yeah. I mean, you said it yourself. We have to have dreams greater than ourselves. I said exactly those same words in Leaving the Earth.
We do.
And that's the reason to send humans. Now, I'll give you a more pragmatic reason.
Yeah, I'm just playing the devil's advocate.
Scientists today are worried that the manned program is going to rob the science research, which means you won't get the science students into the program and you'll lose a whole generation. They say this over and over again.
Right.
They haven't lost that generation for decades. In terms of science education and new scientists, America is booming. But what you do have in the United States, because we haven't pursued the engineering knowledge I mentioned earlier,
right,
going to Mars, we have had a terrible gap in engineers now for the last 15 years.
Man,
There's a terrible deficit.
Robert, I don't talk to any young people who say, I want to be a rocket scientist. You don't hear that.
They don't have it anymore, but they don't have what they see Hubble pictures and the astronomical discoveries, and that gets them so excited to be astronomers, and you have that. But they don't have manned space exploration and the engineering innovativeness that makes people excited about becoming a rocket scientist. Well, if you shift to the manned program, you bring that back. And the truth is the scientists cannot do any of their work without the engineers. The engineers have to come first.
Right.
And though the scientists say we need the scientists, they have tended to be a little short-sighted about the need for engineers. And this is one of the things I've noticed. It's changing. They're beginning to recognize that maybe they shouldn't be so focused on just their own needs, that there's a grander, wider vision necessary to explore things. So, once again, I see we're about to, and then the robots that are bringing back data are just invigorating the whole world. And so, I'm extremely optimistic about the next few decades. Whether it'll be Americans first, I don't know. But the competition is absolutely gearing up, and it's a great thing.
Well, I can tell you this. If it's the Chinese first, then America will get off its duff. Kind of like when it saw Sputnik, when it heard Sputnik, we all went, oh my God, they've done it. We've got to get going. And that could happen again. And China could be the one that would get us there.
China might be. I think it's more likely it'll be the Russians to surprise us just because they have the knowledge and the experience and the infrastructure ready to go. But it doesn't mean it won't be the Chinese. I've said this story on Coast to Coast before, but I want to reiterate it for Americans to know. We see this wonderful picture of the Apollo 11 landing site with the American flag standing there.
Yes.
What most Americans do not know is that flag is not standing there and hasn't been standing there since 1969 when they took off their exhaust from the LEM ascent module, knocked it over. The American flag lies on the ground. And what most Americans have to accept, and I'm giving the American perspective here, even though there's a lot of non-Americans listening, is that when foreigners finally show up to take pictures as tourist astronauts, they aren't going to pick the flag up. And I think we have an obligation just as a nation to have a greater vision and to pick that flag up again. So, and I think it's really beginning to gear up. If it's not going to be the NASA, it's going to be private enterprise. I can give you a quick historical analogy because my original historical background is actually early American history. And Britain is a great analogy to this. In the early 1570s, now I'm going to drop the century number. In the early 70s, they sent a colony to try to establish Roanoke. It failed. And they kind of lost interest through the 80s. The 90s to the aughts. And then around 07, they said, we can do this. We want to compete with other countries like Spain. Let's set up a nuke set of colonies. So they went in 07 to Jamestown, and in 20, they went to the Plymouth Rock, and boom, it happened. And so in terms of human generational development, it's very comparable. We had in 69 going to the moon in the 70s. We kind of lost interest for a few decades. Now we're into the aughts again, and we're saying, hey, we want to do this. And I think we're about to gear up to a really grand adventure.
You're an excited guy, kind of like the Tony Robbins of space. Maybe we need to get you testifying in front of some senator somewhere, and I can almost picture the senator saying, well, Mr. Zimmerman, look, we've got people in America playing devil's advocate here. They're hungry, and we've got 5-6% of people or better out of jobs, and you want to spend money to send men back to the moon or to Mars for what?
Well, I'll tell you this. They don't put the cash in a capsule and launch it into space to burn up every penny spent on Earth. So a person who is starving but has ambitions to dream greater dreams has a potential to work in that industry and create great things. So rather than whine about their starvation, we can give them a dream that will make them great. So that would be my short answer, and I could go on now, as you know, for many hours.
Mr. Zimmerman, senators do not whine, they orate.
No, they whine. I go to congressional hearings all the time, and a lot of them really like to whine.
Yeah.
No, even that's changing. Right. I heard a congressman actually say a few days ago, about a week and a half ago, that NASA administrator said, we want to have absolute safety in launching the shuttle. And this guy took him to task. He said, this congressman said, Vernon Ehlers, actually, this is a congressman, he actually said, you cannot have absolute safety. Your safety record is something to be proud of at NASA, but you will never have absolute safety. And if you want absolute safety, you're never going to go back in space. And I think that's a terrible approach to this. You should instead accept the fact that people are going to die. And for a congressman to say that, I thought was wonderful.
If you want absolute safety, you're not going to get on an airliner.
yes.
You know, you're talking about the shuttle. I do want to talk to you about the shuttle. Yeah. I think Americans are pretty curious about the shuttle. Is it getting too old?
The shuttle, it was time to replace the shuttle, I'd say about 1990.
Right.
The shuttle is one of the most brilliantly designed first generation, first reusable prototype spaceship. If you were, you build a reusable spaceship, it's a first design, you figure out what works and what doesn't, and then, hey, let's turn it around and build a new version that's even better.
Exactly. Hold on, we're at the bottom there. He's exactly right. That's what the shuttle was. I mean, so serviceable, kind of like the B-52 in its time. My God, what a bomber. What a bomber. What a whale of a bomber. And the shuttle was great, but folks, it's time we moved on to something else. Past time we moved on to something else. We'll be right back.
Mississippi, in the middle of a dry spell, Jimmy Rogers on the electrode up high. Mama's dancing, baby on her shoulder. The sun is setting like molasses in the sky.
Talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
And this night with Robert Zimmerman, who is a space historian. We're kind of touching on the shuttle right now, and I'm going to resume with that, and then we're going to talk a little bit about Hubble. A lot of controversy about Hubble and whether it's going to stay up there or deorbit and burn to a cinder. All right, Robert, let's talk about the shuttle a bit. Everybody, I think, agrees it is old and not what it once was, and we would all hope that we're working on or have the next generation all set to go. Where are we?
Well, I would say we don't have the next generation set to go, and we're very far away from that. When Bush made his proposal last January, he said we should retire the shuttle by the end of this decade. And he proposed replacing the shuttle with a manned vehicle he called the Crew Exploration Vehicle. And that vehicle would be a modular setup. It wouldn't just be one vehicle. It would be modular, cargo in separate modules, additional modules to attach to a capsule so that you can extend its capability. That was the overall, just a very, very basic concept. And NASA spent the last year working up what they call a request for proposals, which they put out on the street on March 1st, last week. And that request for proposals is basically asking industry companies, and the industry, aerospace industry, a whole range of companies were involved in working up that RFP, request proposal for proposals. And so the RFP went on the street, and now they're asking by early summer. They want to make a decision. They want to get proposals in from all these different companies on what they envision the Crew Exploration Vehicle will look like. And what NASA's plan is to reward two contracts, sometime in September, to two different companies to build a prototype and fly it unmanned by 2008.
We have the money for this.
Well, that's a good question. I'm now just giving you the plan. I can get into the money in a minute, but let me at least let's set the framework for everybody. So you know what's hopefully going to happen.
All right, design and fly.
Design and fly. And what they're doing is the guy in charge of the exploration department at NASA is a guy named Admiral Chuck Seidel. And he came out of the military and was involved in the Joint Strike Fighter program, where the Defense Department was not very happy with the kind of results they were getting for their procurement contracts. They needed new jets, and they weren't getting them. They'd give out the proposals. They'd get the winner would get the contract, build something that wasn't very good or useful, but they'd been paid anyway. So they started to come up with this idea of having fly-offs, having two competing companies compete for the contract, and then they do a prototype, and then they pick the company they like best. Mm-hmm. And that increased the chances of success. And actually, for the military, it's been reasonably successful. There's a lot of criticisms you can make about it, and it's, once again, government program and bloated, but it's worked. So NASA has brought people in from that military end, and they're starting to copy that. So they're going to have a fly-off in 08. And that'll be exciting in itself. And then the plan is that the winner of that fly-off will then build and fly a manned mission by 2014. Now, having laid that out, I can lay out several problems with that framework. One, where's the money?
The private industry supplies the money to come up with the winning prototype, right?
No, actually not. Congress will be, NASA will be paying them money periodically as the contracts unfold.
I see.
But this way, because it's competitive and they both want to get the full or long-term contract, NASA's more likely to get a successful vehicle flown in 08 rather than something like the X-33, where NASA spent more than $1 billion and given it to Lockheed Martin.
Okay,
but really got zero.
But it's got to be taxpayer money.
It's got to be taxpayer money. Under this plan, it's taxpayer money. Now, will we get taxpayer money? Congress is not sure they're going to do it. The concept that NASA's got is that it won't cost a lot more money. It won't have to increase NASA's budget gigantically, because they're going to phase the shuttle out by 2010. So as they ramp up the Crew Exploration Vehicle, the CEV, they'll be ramping down the shuttle. That's part of their thinking. Now, there is some logic to that, but I'm skeptical. I have to admit, I'm very skeptical that's going to actually happen, partly because the shuttle has to finish the International Space Station for a lot of reasons. That's one question mark. Will the money be there? And Congress has been skeptical. There's no doubt about that.
Right.
The second aspect that makes this whole program somewhat of a problem is that the International Space Station is going to be assembled by 2010, and then we have tired the shuttle. And then what? And then this Crew Exploration Vehicle, the CEV, doesn't fly manned until 2014. Hmm. Well, from 2010 to 2014, how are we going to get humans to our own space station, according to them? That's a question that NASA has not clarified yet at this moment in time. We cannot go to the Russians, because the Iran Proliferation Treaty outlaws paying Russians any money for this kind of technology until they certify they will not provide nuclear weaponry or nuclear technology to Iran.
Well, that's not going so well. As a matter of fact, they just made a deal with Iran. So.
Yes, we did. So they're refusing to do it, and Congress and Congressman Bullard, who runs the House Science Committee, said at a recent hearing, he said, look, I have to tell you, I consider whether we get blown up much more important than NASA's budget.
Mm.
And so they can't go to the Russians. So how do we get out? So that's another gap in this plan, without question. It is possible they could accelerate the program of the CEV. It's very drawn out. I mean, they fly a prototype in 08, and they don't fly a manned mission till 6 years later. And I always go back to the American Gemini program in the 60s. They realized they needed a mid-program between the Mercury and the Apollo program, so they decided in late 1961 that they're going to create a third mid-ground program called Gemini in late 61, and they were flying their first mission in 1965,
mm-hmm.
less than 4 years. Now, that's pretty amazing, and that's a lot shorter than 6 years after you built your first prototype.
Well, those were amazing times, Robert. I'm not sure they're as amazing now in that sense. We don't have that kind of drive, even though I feel it, and I feel that the world, this country, certainly needs it. I'm not sure that we have it.
Well, the "we" there is very important to distinguish, because what you're really referring to is where the NASA and the government has it.
That's right.
And what Burt Rutan and Scale Composites and the XPRIZE proved is that there are Americans that have that, and there are Americans that are enthused by it, and it can happen very fast in other places. Now, NASA might get its act together. I'm not going to say they won't, but there are questions in my mind. Now, we've been talking about the next generation, the shuttle's replacement. We haven't talked about the shuttle itself. The shuttle will fly. It's scheduled now on May 15th for a return to flight. And I think it's really short-sighted to just dismiss this technology. It is available. It is a very useful spacecraft. Even if you retire it around 2010, that doesn't mean the worst thing they could do is decide, okay, we're now going to store it at the Air and Space Museum for people to stare at. It's absurd. These space vehicles should be used either as a heavy lift module that goes into orbit and is permanently there for use, or as the engines and the solid rocket boosters and the external tank can be combined to create a completely new module that can go up to the International Space Station, or even be used, and we'll talk about Hubble later, be used as a way to make a mission to Hubble safer.
Well, the history, though, Robert, isn't good. If you recall what happened to the monstrous engines that got us to the moon, when we decided to abandon all of that so quickly, I think they just rusted, didn't they?
That's right. You're absolutely correct, and this is the concern I have about it's a government program. They don't think in terms of efficiency and practicality. Mm. I mean, you know, there is a completely, for example, with Hubble, they ground two mirrors when they were building Hubble. One of those mirrors, this is incredible, the mirror, granted the mirror on Hubble was slightly off, but they corrected that.
Mm-hmm.
But the second mirror is probably not off. It sits at the Air and Space Museum in Washington to gaze at. That's an incredible investment that should be used as a telescope.
Let's talk about Hubble. Now, I want to know the current status. There's a lot of talk out there that they're going to let it deorbit and burn to a cinder. Others have said, no, we're going to save it or should save it. What is your position on Hubble?
I can probably go an hour on the subject. No, I could probably do a whole show with you on the subject of Hubble.
Well, let's
we won't do that.
Okay.
But I can give you some basics. One, the scientific community decided back in the late 90s that they did not need an optical telescope to replace the Hubble Space Telescope. They decided that the next generation telescope, the James Webb Telescope, would be an infrared telescope so they could do deep space cosmology. Mm. And so I want to put to rest right now anyone on your show that ever says, well, they'll get the James Webb Telescope and that'll replace Hubble. They are lying. It is not an optical telescope, and it has no optical. It does not work in the optical spectrum, so it does not provide you optical pictures of space objects. It gives you infrared pictures. Now, infrared is good, but, you know, to do good research, you need the whole electromagnetic spectrum. And Hubble gives you a very wide range from the ultraviolet to the infrared, and then other telescopes supplement that.
So you're saying we still need Hubble?
I'm not a Hubble hugger, we can replace it. I will very gladly let Hubble fall into the ocean at the right time when we have something to replace it. We have nothing at the moment to replace it.
I've got a little story here sent to me. It says, a new Hubble, While Congress appears to be scrapping the funding for a costly manned or even robotic repair mission for the Hubble telescope, a new option has arisen, dubbed the third way.
Oh, I've heard this.
The Hubble Origins probe pictured, and they've got a picture, is a proposed lightweight space telescope developed by an international team led by John Hopkins University astronomers, supposedly with instruments that would have been the fourth Hubble servicing mission, all the new instruments with Japanese collaborators, blah, blah, blah. Is that true?
That they have made this proposal. It is a much more expensive and less capable instrument that could not get launched very quickly, and probably there'd be a gap before it's launched and the Hubble that's in orbit right now fails. It is not, the simple bottom line thing here is that the cheapest, most effective way and quickest way to keep Hubble running when its gyros, before its gyros and batteries fail in around 2008, is to just simply send shuttle astronauts to do it. Every other solution will cost more, money that NASA does not have, and provide less capabilities. The robot mission, it steps out the window. By the way, that what you were reading is incorrect. Congress has not scrapped money for Hubble. In fact, Congress has allocated in last year's budget that NASA is to spend $300 million on a rescue servicing mission of Hubble, and that money is still allocated, and Congress has audited it. So NASA's saying we're not going to spend that money. They're not the ones to make the decision. NASA's the one that says we want to drop any spending for servicing of Hubble.
That budget hasn't
been approved yet.
Why is NASA making that decision?
Fear.
Fear of?
Fear of failure, of astronauts dying. You see, that NASA administrator right now, the acting NASA administrator, is a man by Fred Gregory. He's a former astronaut.
Yes.
He was testifying in front of Congress, and he was the one who said, use these words, we want to have absolute safety when we launch our astronauts. Hmm. And that's, of course, that's absurd. You can't have absolute safety. And they have taken the attitude, they are fearful of the shuttle. They treat it like it's deathly to send men up in the shuttle. And it's an absurd thing. For a prototype, first-generation reusable spaceship, the first ever built, they have an incredible safety record. They flew over 100 missions and lost two. That's a less than 2% failure rate. And I've said this on the air before, but I'll say it again, it bears repeating. The Clipper ship was the Everest of sailing ship technology. It was the end result of 5,000 years of evolutionary sailing ship design. It was a brilliant ship. They routinely lost 5% per year of all sailing ships, including the Clipper ship, when the Clipper ship was at its heyday. 5% a year, and that was the ordinary loss rate for sailing ships.
Well,
this is a prototype spaceship, and we only lose 2%. It's a great safety record.
You wouldn't expect this kind of sentiment from NASA. I mean, its leader. I mean, NASA, after all, is a space agency. Who would better understand the risks and be prepared and willing to take them than all the people with the right stuff, you know?
No, they don't have the right stuff. It's a government agency. The biggest problem NASA has right now, and this has to do with the CEV and Bush's proposal, is it often strikes me that they don't have the right stuff, that they are timid, that they are fearful, that they want to try to cover their behinds in every way possible to try to avoid anything going wrong. Now, granted, you do want to do that on this stuff. It's dangerous stuff, and you want to try to do as best as possible. But they sometimes take an attitude that prevents them from accomplishing anything. And this attitude in terms of Hubble is an example of that, because if you're going to go to the moon, back to the moon, how can you convince anyone that you're going to do it, including Congress, where they need the money, if you're afraid to send humans to Hubble? The risk is risk for going to Hubble is much less.
Robert, have they actually said that? That the reason they don't want to fix Hubble is because they're afraid?
Yes. No, they say it's safety, though.
Is it safety? Yes or no? Yes. It's a yes?
Yes. They have said It is safety. Yes, they don't want to go. It's not safe.
That it would be too dangerous,
yes,
a mission.
That's right. They have said that repeatedly. In fact, in my most recent Hubble, my most recent UPI column, I talk about this very specifically. They, when asked the question, they say no, cost was not a factor, and it's true. It's really not expensive to send a shuttle mission to Hubble. They've admitted, no, it's safety. The risk is too great. And if you analyze and toss out the actual risk of just sending a shuttle mission as they've done four times before, what you find is that the risk isn't really that great as it is. But it is. They have not even looked into ways to reduce the risk for a shuttle mission, and there are ways that can be done.
You do believe that's their real motive, fear?
Fear. Well, I think deep down, they want to cover their back hinds, and they don't want to take the extra risk of doing this. They also want to get the shuttle finished and not used anymore so that they can focus on the next generation. They also don't want to distract. They'd like to get rid of Hubble as well, by the way, because they see it as a big budgetary bite in there.
What is the current exact status of Hubble? Is it going to be allowed to reenter and burn up, or is it going to be something else going to happen?
Well,
can they maintain it? I can
explain that in some technical detail, actually, without being boring. It has gyros, and it has right now, it has six gyros to begin with. One is completely failed. One is in safe mode, and they don't really trust it to work anymore. There's four left. They need three to do good science.
Right.
They have tested and have actually done some tests that can do some science, reasonable science, with two gyros. Those gyros only have such a certain life expectancy, and they've done a lot of tests, and they've had a lot of experience with this already with the 15 years it's been up. They expect that they will be down to two or one gyro by end of 2007, almost certainly. The other problem is batteries. The batteries on Hubble, they're the greatest, as one engineer told me in the Hubble control room, these are the greatest rechargeable batteries ever made. They've been recharging the Hubble every orbit since 1990. So you're talking about,
pretty good,
you know, tens of thousands of recharges. I can't even give you the number, and they work, but they slowly, the slow decline, and they based on decline, they think they're going to fail sometime. They originally used to say 08. Now they're beginning to say we might actually be able to stretch it to 09. They're really working that well. Now, the gyros, if the gyros fail, you can't do science, but you can put the telescope in safe mode and bring it back to life. If the batteries fail, within 15 minutes, it becomes a pile of junk, because they need to heat the structure of Hubble,
course, yes,
to keep it precise. Once the batteries are gone, they don't have the power to heat it, and basically the hot and cold of orbits would just tear it up.
Can the batteries be replaced?
Well, the plan in either if they sent a shuttle mission, they would either replace the batteries or they would bring new batteries up and attach them to the telescope, one or the other. And they've done the first. They've replaced batteries. Gyros. Now, let's go back for a second to the Hubble Origins, the HOP, the replacement Hubble. One of the reasons that's proposed is that several instruments for Hubble already are sitting at the Goddard Space Flight Center finished, ready to go, including a new camera and a new spectrograph. So those on a shuttle mission can be quickly and easily installed in Hubble and improve the telescope immeasurably without losing its other capabilities.
All right.
And in fact, the astronauts can even repair some of its other capabilities.
All right, Robert, hold it right there. We're at the top of the hour, and we'll be right back. We'll continue with the current Hubble trouble. Hubble's been troubled since it's been up there. Remember all the Hubble trouble headlines? Cute, huh? Anyway, to let it deorbit, to let it fail, or to get a replacement up, what do you think we ought to do? It's money out of your pocket, too, from the high desert in the middle of the night where we do biz. This is Coast to Coast AM.